This is a continuation of the interview in 1987 with Bri Curl. It's now March 3rd, 1987. We're in his office.
Are you ready to begin? Well, I would like to turn to the some of these major events under O'Neill and Earle today, unless you have some comments on these topics up here that we didn't go into last time. I know that they were of moment.
Well, on the enrollment funding formula, you should keep in mind that it was not used at all during any of the time that I was vice chancellor. We never got funding in support of our increased enrollment. So that we went year after year with increased enrollment and with funding toggled together in various ways with the chance to spend the increased tuition. But the funding formula for all practical purposes was abandoned about 1977.
It wasn't that it was coming in and we weren't getting it. It was just that it wasn't coming in.
The legislature gave only lip service to the enrollment funding support. Mm-hmm. It was in part that we weren't getting it because we were getting growth that was unfunded and others. So the proportional distribution was unfavorable to Madison because our growth, when our growth was greater, we did not get corresponding funds. Mm-hmm. This is why fairly early, Chancellor Shane began to talk about the idea of holding the enrollment or rolling it back to let the funding catch up with the number of students that we had to deal with.
Yes. Which didn't work. I mean, we didn't do it.
Well, there's some prospect of them doing it now. At least this is what's being talked about now. Mm-hmm. One of the problems with the general budgetary pattern and policy here is that there hasn't been sufficient incentive to do any planning in the university. For example, I think it was the Medford Center that was closed down and money was saved, a very small amount, but the money was recaptured in the legislature, not left within the system. Mm-hmm. This is a very bad sort of a policy to follow if you want to encourage the changes in programs that generate savings.
That was when Earle was head of DOA, wasn't it?
Don't recall. I wouldn't.
It's interesting. It's something I could ask him about.
The amount of money involved was not great, and the ability to recapture your savings should not be the reason for doing intelligent planning in a system. But if a governor and legislator wanted to encourage tough-minded planning, they would do it by creating monetary incentives as well as other incentives for doing it. And that hasn't occurred in this state.
Well, shall we go on then to the...
All right, fine.
I put the TA strike issue here partly chronologically. And of course, it seems coming up again today. The consequences of it. Would you? You must have been in on how that was handled.
Yeah, I'm not sure what kind of questions. First, there was a decision to keep the university open, and to keep classes meeting, and that did occur. And secondly, I think there was a real effort not to be punitive against anyone. The problem did arise of faculty who did not meet classes, but in that, first, there weren't very many. Secondly, the issue of moving classes to off-campus locations was squabbled about a great deal, was prohibited by a rule of the college, by a ruling of the dean and of the chancellor. And there were faculty who violated that rule, but as I recall, in the end, the penalties were not You'd have to check on the detail on this, but my recollection is that there were no real penalties in the end.
But the crucial event there was the decision not to bargain anymore with the TAs.
The decision not to bargain. There was simply no choice in that matter. An unfair labor practice had been filed against the involvement of the faculty in the bargaining relationship. And we decided that the faculty had to be involved in the bargaining relationship, and if that was an unfair labor practice, we simply couldn't continue to bargain. We then wrote a very formal letter to the TAA inviting them to try to develop with us another relationship that made clear that the faculty was responsible for the academic programs and that the faculty would be involved in the whole thing. First of all, that the faculty's control over academic programs was recognized, and second, that they would be involved to the degree that there were any academic program issues. And the TAA refused to do anything about that invitation. Instead went to court to try to get the bargaining restored through a legal action. They lost on that, and they never did pick up the notion of declaring themselves ready to accept the faculty responsibility. But I think there was no choice on that. We simply could not have continued on the basis that the faculty was excluded from the bargaining relationship. That could not have been done. Although I gather it would be done under the present law, in which the bargaining will be between DER and TAs if they do win a union election. But I still think that's a major mistake. The faculty is, in fact, management. They're declared to be management, and to exclude them was simply impossible. And that's what the termination of the relationship was all about.
So you wonder if there's never been another TA group formed that might have worked toward that kind of setup where you would negotiate with the faculty.
Well, you have to keep in mind that the idea of union activism is a very minor issue among TAs. See, right now we have about 1,500 TAs. I don't think there have ever been more than about 600 who are members of the union. Mm-hmm. It's now down well under 500. So that two-thirds of the TAs, while they may be sympathetic to the idea of unionization, I don't know, we'll find out in the election, but this is not high on their agenda. This has been, frankly, a great deal of the problem. The TAA has been an important outlet for people, for a group of graduate students who are interested in the management of the academic program. This hasn't been wage and hours. Mm-hmm. This is not a group oppressed by long hours at puny wages. As a matter of fact, one of the things that lost the TAA a great deal of sympathy was the discovery that the hourly rate paid to a TA is well above what two-thirds of the population is getting. And it's a fair rate, and it's a rate that helps us get good graduate assistants and good grad students. And it's what we ought to fight for and work for. But this was not a union that was created because of starving sweatshop employees. And it was part, I think, of the late 1960s, early 70s movement for student and grad student involvement in academic policy. And again, much as I believe that there are things that students and grad students can put into the academic planning and policy, I surely don't think that collective bargaining is the way to put that in.
Earl's view of the thing was that the whole thing had been very badly handled and the TAs mistreated and the university more or less had itself to thank for the way it's come through.
He didn't itemize what form this mistreatment took, did he?
No. I will ask him next time.
I wish you would.
Don Smith spoke of his completely ignoring the university president and chancellor and catering to Dave Clarenbach and signing the TA collective bargaining bill. Let's see, that was after you were no longer vice chancellor then, were you?
That's right.
But you must have been very interested in it all.
Sure. Well, let me not personalize this, but put it in general terms. I think that democratic politicians who aspire to national political positions find it very important to do whatever organized labor wants done, because they're very much more dependent on organized labor funding, particularly in the primaries, than Republican candidates will ever be. Mm-hmm. And I think if you try to trace Governor Earle's behavior and that of any other Democratic politician who would like to be in national office, in Congress or other national role, you'll find a great deal of reluctance to do anything that offends labor and a great deal of willingness to do what organized labor wants to see done. Now, I think that's the origin of that thing, mm-hmm. not abuses of the teaching assistants, because I think on balance the teaching assistants here have a very rewarding kind of a job, an interesting kind of a job, and a well-paid kind of job.
And a guaranteed job, which often excludes other graduate students from getting any teaching experience.
Yeah. And which confuses the departments in which the doctoral degree is not the ultimate goal. You see, there are a number of departments where the master's degree is important and the doctorate is not traditional. Master's in nursing is much more common than a doctorate in nursing. Master's in all of the professional fields. Master's in business administration, far more common than a doctorate. And the TA bargaining produced a crazy contract that assumed that all students are working on doctorates.
Going to be around for a long time.
Yeah. Which surely will be the first thing lost if they get into bargaining with DER.
Yes, Don Smith speculated that they might in fact be harmed, and of course it was speculated in the paper today too.
Yeah, I think it's quite likely. I see no reason why DER should bargain for long-range guaranteed employment. And yet, as I think of abuses, one of the worst ones would be to bring a grad student here for a year as TA and then terminate that appointment and let the grad student doing good work and making satisfactory progress find his or her own funding.
Oh, sure.
That is an abuse.
Yeah.
So the long-range guarantee for those who need it is not a bad thing at all. And I am afraid it's one of the things that'll be lost in bargaining, because I don't see why DER should bargain for that.
But what about the students who are graduate students and because there's not enough money for TAs don't get a chance ever to be a TA? I have to have one working for me, so.
Yeah. No, I do appreciate that by having the long range guarantee and the minimum percentage, you do concentrate the teaching experience in a smaller number of hands. You do that anyway, though. Of our 9,000 graduate students, probably 35% are on their own funding and never get a chance to be either a TA or a research assistant. It's not as good in education. The real education here for a grad student is to have sometime as a research assistant, sometime as a teaching assistant, and then do the other things that go into the PhD. Mm-hmm. But you can't provide that for the whole group anyway. So I think it's a trade-off.
As you look through these questions, does this seem a reasonable order to go in? Or?
Well, I'm not sure how much of these I can shed much light on.
Well, I'd like you to talk about O'Neill. what your encounters with him were and what you thought of him as president?
I think he probably had, right from the start and right through his time here, the wrong picture of what the job was. The job is really carrying out the relationships with the governor and the legislature on behalf of a group of institutions that will at least make some effort to be independent from one another and that are quite different in their nature. And I believe what he thought, or at least hoped the job was the intellectual leader of a great flagship university and its satellite campuses. And that's not what the system has ever been, and that's not what it ever will be. I think it was quite troublesome to him and troublesome to us that in the national setting, it was never quite clear whether the system was being represented or the UW-Madison. Mm-hmm. For example, I think I may have mentioned earlier the CIC structure in which the Big Ten vice presidents for academic affairs meet regularly and talk about things that they have in common. Mm-hmm. They talk about library access and how important it would be for a UW-Madison grad student to have easy access to the Chicago and Michigan libraries. But as the fellow from Chicago said, we don't have the same thing in mind on the UW-Eau Claire. This is simply, on the other hand, O'Neill believed that he or his vice president should be the representative of the UW system in CIC.
And was that the way it went?
Nope, because CIC dug in its heels and said, that's not what we want. We want the UW-Madison because that's the institution that's like ours. And that distinction is one that O'Neill never did want to make and never did make. And for that reason, I think he's much more at home in an institution where he is the academic leader for a single integrated university.
And what about the AAU?
Well, that's the kind of issue. Is the UW system a member of AAU or is the UW-Madison? It's clear that if you view AAU as the major research and graduate teaching and good undergraduate universities in the country, the top ones, the top 30 or 40, whatever it is, I guess it's up near 50 now, out of 4,500 universities in the country, it's clear that the UW-Madison is the member, not the UW system.
Young had actually hung on to it for himself until the very end, I guess, of the AAU
Young?
Membership, when he was president.
Well, he was only president for a short time and I think did take steps to move it over to the UW-Madison, begin steps mm-hmm. as soon as it was feasible to do it. But that, as you know, did not occur. What they ended up with was an uncomfortable sort of joint membership.
Oh, really? I thought it was completely O'Neill when he came.
It was. But as time went by, AAU, too, like CIC, pressed to make sure that both were involved, the system and the UW-Madison.
So
they didn't do this officially. They did it by personal contact.
Uh-huh. So Chancellor Shane did go to the meetings then?
You would have to ask him and check calendar on that. He certainly was involved with their activities and served on task forces or other bodies for AAU.
Hmm. That's presented as one of the major causes of friction between them.
Well, it was certainly a cause of discomfort, both for us and for AAU, because the interests of AAU were the interests of large and very good universities. And it's a source not so much of friction as of confusion when the person who is directly responsible for this university and can answer questions about its programs and about its policies is not there, and somebody from the system who doesn't have firsthand knowledge is there. That caused problems not just for us, but for AAU. But it was that continued uncertainty on O'Neill's part as to what his role was, and therefore on the UW-Madison's part.
And is it true that Jane never had a chance to entertain the regents as such, I mean, as chancellor, the way the other chancellors did?
I wouldn't. See, the other chancellors did only once every so often because
when the regents met there,
of course. But the regents met at Platteville only once every 7 or 8 years, at Eau Claire once every 7 or 8 years, and so on. And since the regents met about, 10 times a year in Madison, you surely don't have them entertained by the Madison chancellor each of those times, or even any substantial number of them.
But do you have them once?
I am sure that on at least one or two occasions, the Madison chancellor did entertain the regents. I don't know that from, just to have a vague recollection of it. Mm. But it is true that you do have a question. When they're meeting here in Madison, what is their relationship to the Madison chancellor? And obviously they are system regents. And in general, you would expect them to have their closest relationship with the president of the system. So I don't see that as a major issue. To put it another way, entertaining the regents is not all that important in the great big world.
It's very interesting. O'Neill had them every month to his house.
Yep.
Apparently they didn't all of them like going there. They used to use the time to go down to the Capitol and talk to the legislators. Enjoy life in Madison. Where it wasn't that enthralling having spent the day together to go out.
I think you're spending more time on this than it deserves. I would think it's absolutely proper for the president of the system to say, if you'd like to come out to my house on whatever night it is, there'll be a bottle on a bar and a plate on the table, and if they want to come, they can, and if they don't want to come or have other things that are more important, they don't need to. I don't think this is that kind of an issue. I think you would expect that the president of the system would offer entertainment to the regents every time they meet here. And you'd expect that the attendance would fluctuate depending on what their other demands on their time were.
And would you want to comment on the social relations, strain and social relations between the O'Neills and the Shanes?
No. Again, you got the problem of, let's say there's a dedication of a building here, or a groundbreaking, or the unveiling of a plaque or the honoring of some faculty. On the one hand, the UW-Madison departments and program units are, the head of the institution is the chancellor, and you want to make sure that the chancellor, and if it's a spousal affair, the spouse, are there. At the same time, you don't want to be insulting or disdainful of the system president. And so, sure, there were all kinds of occasions, and there always will be, when people don't know, shall we invite all four or only two, and if so, which two? Mm-hmm. And I think that's inevitable, and probably, again, not as important as your questioning makes it sound.
You don't think it was?
No. I think it's bound to occur and has to be lived with. It's one of the prices of having a system structure. Would not occur, let me point this out, suppose the system administration were located at Fond du Lac then this issue would disappear, wouldn't it? So I would not put it in terms of the personal relationships between A and B. I'd put it in terms of the structural problems that occur when you have a system headed by a president and an institution headed by a chancellor, and they're both located in the same city and even on the same campus. I'm only astonished that there isn't more friction.
From what you say, maybe Madison would be better off if the system were someplace else.
I would think there'd be a great deal to be said for having a system located in neutral territory, and I'm not thinking now about Madison being better off. I'm thinking about the problem that other universities have of, oh, those Madison people can get their hands on the system people any time of the day or night.
That's the usual position, but it suddenly occurred to me that maybe even Madison would be better off.
I hadn't thought that. No, I think there would be much to be said for having system administration located in relation to state government rather than in relation to one of the campuses.
Mm-hmm. You will agree that there was friction between O'Neill and Shane.
Sure.
Or I say agree. I mean, there was. Was there? Because my final question was, how much did it affect things that happened?
The friction that I saw was primarily professional and was the question of where the lines of authority are. And I'd say there was, on the part of Madison, every effort to make sure that our authority and our prerogatives were preserved. And in general, I would say that the system administration, and I don't mean just the president, I mean the vice presidents and the others, did their best to comply with that. But where there's uncertainty, there's going to be confusion, and there's going to be time wasted in sorting out the lines. And sure, there is time wasted in sorting out the lines.
I guess they agreed on the major issues, obviously, things like faculty salaries.
On a great many things, they surely did agree, yeah.
I was just thinking of, in the files are letters that O'Neill has written to Shane and the memos.
Along what line?
Oh, urging, wanting to get together and talk about the future of the university. They're mm-hmm. kind of pleading almost. A couple of them.
I guess I don't really follow that, nor do I believe it.
Mm-hmm.
They met regularly. Don't your records or don't your interviews show that they were together for a couple of hours every couple of weeks?
No. In the files, all you see are you don't see.
Well, all right. Then I will say for the record that they met regularly,
uh-huh.
certainly no less often than every 2 weeks,
uh-huh.
in many periods as often as once a week.
In O'Neill's office?
Usually in O'Neill's office, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an opportunity to go over issues. See, the other thing is that the president of the system should never be surprised by things that happen at the principal university in the system. So one of the problems that the chancellor has, one of the responsibilities, is to make sure that the president of the system is fully informed regularly about everything that is likely to make headlines or come to the attention of the regents or have an impact on the long-range future of the system. Again, I would not be surprised if the president of the system felt that occasionally he was blindsided. I'd be surprised if he wasn't, because you can't remember everything.
Mm-hmm.
But there were regular meetings, frequent meetings, and detailed meetings. And in general, cordial meetings.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds as if the impression you get from the files is that there was only occasional contact and then only by letter. At least
yes,
that's what your question indicated.
You would think that.
All right.
I wonder why people don't save their calendars. It'd be very valuable.
Oh, they do.
Well,
I'll bet you.
Put them in the archives.
I'll bet you that. Well, I suppose the reason they wouldn't be archived is that an individual's calendar has both personal and professional mm-hmm. things on it, and the professional belong in the archives, and the personal don't belong in the archives, and you can't go back and reconstruct a document like that. But I would be surprised if anybody in a leadership role doesn't preserve those calendars.
Well, you know, I'm talking about in the archives.
And surely at some point they ought to be available to the archives. I would think the archivist might request them after a decent period or... See, first of all, you would want to hang on to your calendar as long as you might need to refer to it. Mm-hmm. And that may be as long as 5, 6, 7 years, even assuming you're not going to write memoirs or something. But at the end of that time, again, if a person were concerned about the personal things in the calendar, they could be... It could be submitted and sealed for a period, and I don't think anybody would object to that if...
But they'd have to have a fairly colorful personal life to object to having a personal calendar, so...
The dentist and...
Well, all right, what about the Earl's campaign and your... support for him and your expectations of what he would do?
Well, I don't think my support for Earl was not, I don't think it took the form of any campaigning for him or anything of that kind, nor was it based on a view of this is the man who will do great things for the university. I think it was based on a general view that his attitudes, as expressed on resource problems and on education generally and on welfare issues, things of that kind, were more nearly mine than were his opponents.
And you had him to your house once and talked to him in May, with other faculty members.
Don't think at my house, but I was at a meeting in May where a number of faculty members visited with him. Yeah.
Did you fit with Dreyfus when he ran?
No,
I... It wouldn't have been much point, but...
Had contact with him after he was governor, but not during his campaign.
Now, what about... Oh, really, I should ask you the question that's here at the bottom in the context of our discussion of the president of the system and the Madison Chancellor, because the comment that Earl made was the extent to which other campuses would be relieved now that Shane had gone, because they really felt, they were paranoid about it, they really felt he'd always run the system, and the new chancellor would be one of them. Would no longer be the person who ran the system.
I don't understand what they meant by that, because I don't think it's at all correct to say that the UW-Madison or the Chancellor of Madison ran the system, or ever will. But it is correct to say that any good Board of Regents and any good president and any good governor are going to be worried about the future of this university to a little greater degree than future generally of others. And as a result, when this university says we have a problem, the system and the governor are likely to listen. That doesn't mean that they're likely to settle it in our way, but if any other institution thinks that the intense concern about the future of this university on the part of public officials and system will disappear when you have a different chancellor, they're crazy. This is a much more important resource to the state, and therefore a much more source of concern, much greater source of concern than any single other university in the system. That ought not to be any news to anyone.
It's surprising in a way that Earl said that. I suppose he's reflecting views that have been expressed to him by other chancellors.
Mm-hmm. I think other chancellors, too, felt that Shane was quite forceful and was not ever unwilling to state a position, to make the arguments, to get the issues on the table. And they may feel that there is a chance of getting a chancellor who is less aggressive in that way. I don't think so. I think, again, that anybody likely to be chosen for chancellor of this kind of university is likely to be somebody who has a record of speaking out frankly and of putting the cards on the table, of making the arguments, of arguing the needs of his institution or her institution.
Did you see much of Earl when you were vice chancellor?
Not on any official or university-related basis. I'd say probably four or five times we visited socially, mm-hmm. but or were at events where we had conversations, but not. I wasn't in his office very often. And he wasn't in mine at all.
How was contact made between him and Madison?
I'd say in general they were confined to contacts through the system. But obviously there were a lot of faculty members who knew the governor. There were a lot of things that he encountered in the course of conversations with faculty. Mm-hmm. There may have been, and I'm sure were, times when he talked with individual administrators here on something that where he had a particular interest, mm-hmm. and that would have included the chancellor.
But you didn't have any regular established way of talking to him?
No. I think that probably would have been improper to have any regular established way. That does have to work through the system. In other words, you wouldn't want to have Madison arguing with the governor along one line without having had that same argument carried through the system. You wouldn't want to be in the spot of undercutting a regent policy or decision, or trying to. So that when I said that the chancellor met with the president regularly, one of the things he would report at such a meeting would be all of his contacts with state government. He would not leave any doubt in the system's mind as to what he had done, what he'd said. You simply couldn't have an independent, somebody running an independent foreign policy.
But you did point out that forcefully last time that the system had to treat the whole set up as equal.
No, I didn't. What I said is that there are pressures to do that. They don't have to. They have to do the opposite. They have to recognize the differences and present those differences. But no, there are pressures at all times for them to treat the institutions as if they were similar. But that's the job of the regents and the president, to face the differences and to take care of them.
So you felt that you were always adequately represented downtown by...
No, no. But the best route for representation is through the system.
Yes,
on the executive branch. On the legislative branch, this is quite different. There is no question that both the chancellor and Harry Peterson, working with him in legislative matters, and some of our deans frequently were in touch with legislators. Again, I would think that in general, these contacts were reported to system. They were aware of them, and these didn't take the form of trying to overturn system policy, but there were Madison, particular Madison issues where you would deal with the legislature. Yeah. That's much less likely to occur with the governor, because the governor does have, see, the president of the system is in effect a member of the governor's cabinet, or at least the head of a state agency, the head of a major state agency. So your route to the governor is much more through that channel. Now, I think the relationships between this kind of university and state government and the system are very delicate and have to be treated delicately. You cannot have one institution. The state agency here is the UW system, and it is headed by the president. And you can't have subunits of that deliberately fighting or blocking what's been set as policy at the presidential or regents level. Now, where policy hasn't been set, then sure, you can have contacts. And where a request is initiated at the other end of State Street, we want information on so-and-so, you can have contacts. I think there's an obligation, which, so far as I know, was quite carefully met, to keep system informed of what you're doing and of the positions you're taking. And surely there's an obligation not to fight at the governor's level to overturn a regent and president's decision. And I don't know of that ever happening.
Yes, I think we're talking about information.
But what you're more likely to get, let's say, well, this particular governor, Earl, was very much interested in relationships with China. And this university, not the system, but this university had and has some pretty elaborate relationships with the academic community there. And so, most natural thing in the world for the governor to say, here's what I need to know about these institutions in China, can you help me out? And to have a direct relationship of that kind. But it's also proper for the chancellor to let the president of the system know that that's happening. I'd say there are more cases of that kind where this university is unique and therefore the relationships will be direct than with other units in the system. It doesn't change the basic principle that once a policy is set, once the regents and the president have determined a policy, the regents really, and the president has been told to carry it out, that policy has to be carried out. Your fight then is with the regents, not with the governor or legislature.
I don't think I am talking about fighting for something, although it might come to that, but I'm talking about giving information about why Madison needs the kinds of things it does, that the governor might need to know about.
Well, there's never been any obstacle put in the way of providing information to state agencies, or either legislative or executive. But that's not what I thought you had in mind.
No, I thought I just meant a regular contact with the governor.
No, I don't think you would ever. I don't think you'd ever have, and I don't think you'd want to have a regular contact of one institution with the governor, because I don't know how you could keep that out of the situation of providing a forum for second-guessing the regent decisions.
Well,
ad hoc relationships are a whole lot more sensible there than regular contact. Although, from a UW-Madison point of view, I would welcome having the opportunity regularly to put our position before the governor. But I don't think it would be, once you've got a system, you have to manage it as a system. And
what about things like athletics?
Well, what about them?
Well, sometimes the governor gets interested in.
Does anybody except the governor think that that's proper?
You don't?
I certainly don't. I was shocked at the announced governor's belief that he had had a voice in whether we retained an athletic director. I don't think that's an appropriate role for a governor to take.
Has it ever happened before?
Oh, sure. happens in the southern universities regularly.
No, I meant here.
Yeah, intercollegiate athletics. I don't know of a case quite like that, but intercollegiate athletics is a peculiar thing that does have a spillover into politics. If the governor were talking about whether to retain a particular professor in the history department, you know how outraged we'd be. Or even a particular manager of nursing in the hospital. Mm-hmm. But intercollegiate athletics, we all recognize, has its peculiarities. I think it was improper, but not unusual.
Was the chancellor influenced by it?
You'd have to ask the chancellor, but my own strong impression was that he was not. That decision was made just exactly the way it would have been without a concerted campaign of phone calls. Mm. And this was part of a concerted campaign.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, that's not very important, but I suppose it is really.
No. I think that decision came out just the way it would have without this kind of interference. Mm-hmm.
Well, all right, let's go on to the really interesting topic, which is the Star Fund and the salary freeze. Your account of your perceptions of how it developed and why, who were the important people in it?
It developed at that end, so far as I know, it developed in legislature and executive branch, not at the university. Star Fund. And the Star Fund, I think, was a major mistake, although at that point and even now, I'd say we welcomed salary support wherever we could get it because we were in a really desperate situation. But the idea that $1 million distributed among the institutions in the UW system, and keep in mind it did have to be distributed, and the terms of distribution produced all sorts of complaints, because if it's distributed equally, it didn't help where the major problems were, and if it was distributed mostly to Madison, then the others all resented the fact that this sounded as if the stars were all at Madison. Okay, then you whittle it up into little bits, and you end up with whatever it was we got, maybe $400,000. And at that point, this gives you the opportunity to put $10,000 on each of 40 people out of 2,400. And it was the salary scale as a whole that was bad, not the salary scale of the stars. And then the other thing is, I think the whole perception of the salary problem was warped, was twisted. The senior faculty member, the star that we're talking about, many of them were much less interested in adding $10,000 to their salaries than in having a salary structure that would permit them to bring in the best new assistant professors countrywide. You see that over and over. We did a run at one point on the salary increases of Vilas professors, who are supposed to be our best and most prestigious. Quite consistently, they get lower percentage salary increases than the assistant professors, although they're involved in setting the salary increases for the assistant professors. What this means is that they're concerned about the salary structure, not about their own salaries, and, or at least much more about the salary structure than about their own. And so the Star Fund caused maximum tension both between this university and others, and maximum tension within the institution, who are the stars, and did virtually nothing about the problem that really mattered. And in addition, in salary terms, was not really adequate to take care of the stars. Now, having said all that, I would say that we took what we could get out of it because it helped. It might have been bailing the ocean with a teaspoon, but at least it was a teaspoon, and it made the problem that many $1,000 less at a later point when we really addressed it.
Was it important to have established the fact that you ought to give more money to top professors?
No, it didn't. That had always been the case. The salary ranges here have been very wide for many, many years. The stars have gotten much better paid than the newest or the middle group.
Or maybe in the public's eye, to establish the fact that it was important to keep people here. Did it have an effect there?
I'm not sure. My impression is that it did not, but to the extent it did, fine.
Mm. So, but from your point of view, it really didn't accomplish anything, except
sure, it added that much to the resources to deal with a major problem. But it did not, it was really literally a Band-Aid.
Mm-hmm. Now, to begin with, the $1 million Star Fund that was suggested in January, and then Earl's budget, which called for a salary freeze, first by any. And the versions I've gotten from the two sides are completely different. And I'm curious how you perceived the salary freeze, how necessary it was, whether you expected it.
Totally unnecessary. And I would not have expected it because it represented extremely bad management. It was unnecessary because this particular amount wasn't what balanced or failed to balance the state budget.
The increase,
faculty salary increase. Now, it may very well have permitted the governor and legislature to hold the line on other salaries. And they may have felt that if they yielded at all on faculty salaries, then they couldn't hold the line on classified salaries, other state pay scale. On the other hand, that's what their job is supposed to be, to decide what they need to do to maintain state services at high quality. And that was not done. We ran a terrible risk of severe loss of good faculty and academic staff. I think the reputation of the institution, the availability of WARF research funding, the quality of the community, those are the things that got us through. And I think a growing conviction on the part of faculty that something was going to be done. Those are the things that got us through. But it was a very risky kind of a thing, and I don't believe it was necessary, except for those political reasons. And I think it was a management mistake.
Well, you say, may have thought, that, or may have felt that they had to do it to keep the other state employee salaries from going up. This seems to have been the reason.
All right.
And apparently that had been established back in the 70s when they got their bargaining bill. I'm not sure whether it was before then, but the faculty salaries and state employee salaries went up the same.
Mm-hmm.
So if you took faculty salaries and put them up and didn't put state employees' salaries up, you couldn't do it. Is that right?
No, that's not right. Lots of institutions and states have done it.
Well, I mean in Wisconsin.
In California, for example, they had different salary increase rates for the different institutions.
Oh, yes. No, I mean in Wisconsin.
Well, why not?
It's rather unique.
Why not?
The thing is, Earl had inherited this practice. He didn't make it up. pointed out.
He'd inherited it from a very few years before.
So back in the 60s, it wasn't like that, is that right?
Nope, that's right. And sure, it's easy for a non-politician to say what political courage would be in a particular case. It would seem to me that if he believed that the salary scale was wrong, political courage would have required that he fight for a different scale. If he didn't believe it was a bad scale, then there should have been, on the part of himself and DER, some exploration of comparative salary rates. They shouldn't have had, the university shouldn't have had to bring to them the evidence that this salary scale was non-competitive. This was their job to dig up the evidence. And in fact, later on, when that evidence was developed, they did give a differential set of salary scales. So at a later point, they did bite the political bullet. And they did it by the device of getting the evidence and making the argument that if you want Wisconsin to compete with Michigan and Minnesota and Illinois and Ohio State, this is what you have to do. Well, that's the thing that should have been done at the start, not after 2 years of agony.
What about the fact that there was a huge budget deficit, and therefore, and that the recession was still going on? I guess it reached its peak or its depth in January, when Winterell was developing his budget, so that he couldn't know that there would be enough money to do it, to raise salaries.
It would have been the governor's job to solve that problem, and to solve it either by cuts elsewhere or by increased sources of revenue, of which there are two. One is in the tax area and the other is in the university tuition area. $50 a year increase in tuition throughout the university system would have covered that. Now, we've had increases a good deal larger than that since. So the idea that was an impossible thing to do. I don't want to load this on tuition. I'm simply saying that as his people sat around saying, we have a problem, is there a solution for it? There were solutions to be found. I think there was never a recognition that they had a problem. They did nothing to find out what the comparative salary rates were.
Apparently, according to Don Smith, they were told, he was on the faculty, the university committee, faculty compensation committee, and they reported to Earl in December or January what the state of things were. And he said they didn't listen.
That's right. And it was their job to listen. Now, I do want to put one thing on the record on this this linked salaries of academic staff, classified, and faculty.
This is the second tape of the March 3rd session with Breitko.
I'd like to put something on the record on the linking of classified employee salaries with those of unclassified in the university. Classified employees get increases in pay that relate to new positions and promotions. Nobody has quite figured out how much these amount to, but I think the best guess has been they're somewhere between 1 and 1.5% of the salary base each year. Let me give you an example in a different setting altogether, the armed forces. If the armed forces went for 20 years with a zero increase in salaries, the person who was a second lieutenant 20 years ago would not be getting the same salary today as then, because that person would be a major or a lieutenant colonel or a colonel and would be getting a considerably higher salary. The same thing is true in classified employment anywhere. Now, in the university, there have never, until very recent years, been any raises at all related to change of status. So when the classified employees get 5%. They're getting 5% plus an imputed 1.5% on promotions or reclassifications. When the faculty gets 5%, they're getting 5%. Mm-hmm. Now, you do that for 7 years, and it had been done for 7 years, and you get a scale that's quite out of balance, even though the record says the two groups have been treated alike. And that's a thing that some effort has been made to get some understanding of, but it's not clearly understood even to this day. However, there is a good deal more flexibility now to recognize that difference. But it's an important difference. And it's one that I guess I can't say that I know when that was pointed out to the governor and his people, but surely they heard that or understood it at some point and failed to act on it.
Do you remember the that crucial meeting of the Joint Finance Committee in July, when it was had been understood that the that not only the Star Fund but the additional 2.5 million that was being asked for was going to be a permanent addition, and then it was announced suddenly that it was just a one-time thing?
Mm-hmm.
What's your
I was not at that meeting, and I don't. So I don't have any comment on it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you think about the task force, about the forming of the task force?
Well, this was a very sensible thing to do.
Do you know how that got started, or whose idea it was?
I suspect that the governor himself thought of that, that he concluded that he had a problem here that wasn't going to go away, and that a good way to deal with it was to put together a group that included citizens and university people and legislators and executive branch, and let them have at it. And either they would come up with the conclusion that the salary scale was not out of line nationally, or that it was out of line, and if they concluded it was out of line, then they could make it move and would have public support for what they did. And I think it worked fairly effectively in that direction, although it was clear at the first meeting of that group that DER and DOA were not at all convinced about the salary scale and were not prepared to look at it reasonably.
Hmm. Were they there?
Doris Hansen was a member of the group. And provided the first tables, which tried to compare the UW system, the UW-Madison, with the average of land-grant universities throughout the U.S. And of course, we're a little above that, although not far. And it was a terrific fight to try to get that turned around so that they were looking at a true peer group, instead of a group that included everything from University of Nebraska to University of New Mexico to Montana State.
Were you keeping in touch with what was going on in the task force?
I sat in the audience in their meetings, because there was nothing more important going on at that particular point.
We'll talk about it. What they were like, and what were the crucial steps?
Oh, I think the crucial step was that decision to move from the data that DOA brought in, not truly dealing with a sensible peer group, to move from that to a definition of a peer group that was much like the universities we compete with. And in the end, the peer group that was laid out for Madison was a good one. We did have a chance to make suggestions as to what that peer group should be. And primarily it was defined as the Big Ten with a couple of additions to it. On the other hand, probably a fairer peer group would have been one that included some of the private universities, because they are the ones that with whom we compete. But in the end, a peer group that was the state, the major state universities in the Midwest, the Big Ten, is a pretty good kind of a comparison, and we showed up, as we expected, well below that one. And so that target of bringing us up to that peer group was fine. That's what should have occurred.
How was Doris Hansen talked out of her initial?
I think the group as a whole, the whole group in the task force, almost all saw that this was not an appropriate comparison. A real pillar of strength in that was Arthur de Bartoleben, who simply said, those aren't the universities you compete with. And people like Mary Lou Muntz, who is very persuasive and very sensible, and when she pointed out that this is not an appropriate comparison, the view then was that, well, this was a starting point. Let's go on to an appropriate comparison, and they did.
And what about the Eau Claire? There was a man from Eau Claire, a Taubman, and the Union man, and a man from Janesville. How did they, where did they stand? Did they approve of this peer group comparison?
Well, see, a peer group was developed for them also, a comparable.
Did they mind being separated, having Madison separated?
I think they would much rather have had a single peer group. They'd much rather have. And later on, as you know, they argued very strongly that now we've got the Madison shortfall defined, let's take care of that and treat all of us alike. So there was an effort to get away from the peer group but in the end they got very fairly and favorably treated. And you see, in the task force itself, the basic issue, not which university is underpaid, but are university faculty members underpaid, there was a general consensus among the university group that that was the situation. So there was no basis for argument there.
And Doris Hansen agreed with that, did she?
Eventually, yeah.
What kind of a person was she? Was she a bureaucrat, or?
Well, she is a bureaucrat.
She is a bureaucrat. That doesn't always make one the A block one.
And it was her job to husband the state's resources. And from her point of view, I think it was her job to force anybody who made an argument about the need for more spending to prove that that was the case. So I don't think it's altogether fair to cast her as a villain in this piece. This was what she was supposed to do, although I would say that it seemed to me she was a little slow to recognize how bad the situation was.
Yeah. Earl said that there were two important differentials established there. One is the differential between the faculty and the other state employees. I haven't seen that talked about. It does seem important.
Well, the fact that there was a special catch-up for faculty in relation to other state employees was, yes indeed, an important distinction. This was the first step to separate the lockstep same percentage for all state employees. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that distinction was made and was useful.
He's not at all certain that it'll continue. He said it's important that it should, but it doesn't necessarily have to.
Then it's very clear that even to this day he doesn't understand that point that I was making about the difference between a fixed percentage for faculty and a fixed percentage in a classified structure.
No, I meant he feels that the governor and the legislature could eliminate the differential.
Yeah, they can.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, if the two percentages don't mean the same thing, then the differential is identical percentages are not identical treatment.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, he's very much, or says he, very much in favor of it.
Yeah. No, I think it'll be necessary to keep alive that argument about identical percentages not meaning identical treatment. It's not an easy concept to grasp, but it's important, and it does explain why faculty salaries get further and further behind when they're paired with a classified system.
Were you people horrified when you saw what O'Neill had done in immediately lifting the percentage of the other campuses up to 9% without getting anything in return for it?
Horrified is not the word, but I...
Were you aware of what was going to happen?
I would have predicted what would happen. The time to drive a bargain is before you've made your... before you've signed and locked in your offer. And that's one thing that was not done on that, apparently.
But did you recognize that this was a mistake?
Oh, yeah, sure. I am sure that the president felt that he had been dealing with them generously, that they would not, they'd all say, fine, let's go. And I think it probably surprised him and did not surprise me. Although one of the statements that came out of it, I think someone in the rest of the system said they are not going to shove a 9% raise down our throats.
10%.
10%.
Yes, and that's the classic remark of the century.
Yeah. And that helped very quickly to clarify in legislators' minds the difference.
So what people would you assign the getting through finally of the catch-up? I mean, who were the important figures?
Well, you won't expect this, but I think the governor was indeed terribly important on it. It would not have occurred if the governor hadn't decided that he needed to do something. And the task force was a useful device to build into that. Then in the task force, clearly the university committee here and the people that the university committee mobilized to help explain the case and to help gather data were important to it. In the legislative leadership, I wouldn't be prepared to say who the key people were, but I'm sure it would not have come about without both the Democratic and Republican leadership being sympathetic to it. People like Tom Loftus and Tommy Thompson both had to be ready to help on it. And then in that task force, the towers of strength, in my opinion, were Arthur de Bartoleben, because he is so outspoken and has such a reputation for integrity. Mary Lou Muntz, for some of the same reason, and because she's so clear and articulate. John Pellegrin, because as a businessman, he came onto the committee and said, this is not the way you run a business, underpaying your key employees. And Fanny Lemoyne, a very important role, because she was a good, solid, respected faculty member who did her homework, had facts to back up what she presented. I'm sure I've left out some people who should have been mentioned, but those
Where
are...
Where would you put the O'Neill and the Regents?
I'm sure that behind the scenes, the Regents worked very effectively on this. For example, I suspect that Dave Beckwith used every contact he had to make clear that the facts were brought out, that the case was understood, and other Regents too. The Regents, as a group, were very effective. I don't think, for that particular function, that O'Neill was that important. Now, Catherine Lyle was a member of the task force, and obviously she was there as a representative of the president, and she was a useful member too. But I don't think at that point that the president's role was a major one.
She was useful, was she?
Oh, sure.
one of the principal results of the catch-up seems to have been this serious situation with the academic staff, or at least some people have said that they, Dave Cronin may have a case for the effects on from Madison. And academic staff has been an interest of yours. So I'd be kind of interested in your giving a history of how the treatment of the academic staff developed. I know you were working at it long before any of this came up.
The academic staff problem is one that has its roots in the soft money issue. We have, $200 million a year that comes into the UW-Madison from external gifts and grants now, every year, and a large share of it goes for salaries. And many of these gifts and grants and contracts are 1 year only, although renewable. And you cannot appoint people with permanent commitment, particularly when the people concerned are highly specialized. Let's say you've got a sizable grant in a specialized cancer research field and you need three or four people. You can make jobs for three or four people for a year or for 2 or 3 years to do a particular kind of cancer technology and cancer research. 4 years later, the grant runs out and these people can't be transferred to the soils department or the history department. If they're to continue, it's because somebody can figure out how to build them into at least a closely related biological science. And the very definition of unclassified means that you can't slot this person and say you can be transferred at any moment. A typist ought to be transferable from one unit to another. A receptionist, a computer, a programmer, all of these things are somewhat transferable. But as you go along the line to degrees of specialization, they're not transferable, and yet they're on soft money. And we have that problem now, and we'll continue to have that problem. It'll be a major problem, would be, if academic staff unionized, because you'd simply have procedures for layoff. And layoff would be the normal expectation. You cannot build job security into a fiscally insecure structure. So you try to build it in as best you can by putting all the pressure on you can to plan ahead, to find places for people who are bumped out of one job, to give them some, you can't even give them priority in a job that they're not qualified for, but at least to give them advance notice of what jobs might be coming up. All of those things you can do. Now, on salaries, clearly these are people who are more nearly like faculty than they are like classified. They are not members of the union. Classified employees are. And so when, of course, the pressure was on faculty salaries because this is where the rating from other institutions comes. The rating does not come at the academic staff level. So if you're saying, how do we head off this decimation of our faculty by raids from other places, you do it by faculty salary adjustment. Then you leave the whole bunch of academic staff saying, hey, how about us? We're professionals too of the same kind, and our salary scales have suffered and do need to be picked up. And there's a lot of merit to that argument. But it wasn't built into the case because the case was made on the danger of outside, either our inability to recruit good people or our loss of our best people to other universities. And that wasn't a factor in the academic staff thing. So that's why the academic staff thing came out to be a problem. And the provision of catch-up funding for academic staff was absolutely essential. It had to be done. It would have...
Well, you wouldn't have lost many if you hadn't. I mean, you wouldn't have lost many academic staff. They wouldn't have quit.
You wouldn't immediately have lost money, but you would have had a real sense of grievance. And you would also have, in the long run, lost in quality. In the long run, you academic staff generally are not as mobile as faculty because so many of them are tied to a spousal arrangement where there are two jobs involved, and in a sense they're just filling in, but in another sense they're having a career just like the spouse is having. And so you're not as likely to lose them in the short run, but you are much more likely over the long run to lose quality if your salary scale is out of line. And you also have a good deal of unhappiness and evidence of unfairness. Now, what I think we should have done, should do even now, is a whole lot more in comparative salary ranges, again with peers, so that our academic staff are treated as well as those at Minnesota and those at Ohio State. And we haven't. That has not been done. The catch-up procedures have all been sort of internal, and I'm not altogether happy with the way they've come out. I think there's some cases where we'll be paying some groups of academic staff much more than the market and some others much less than the market because we haven't really looked at the market properly. But something had to be done, and I'm glad that something was done.
What was the basis of the catch-up that you did several years ago?
For academic staff? The legislature did provide funding as a tie-on to the faculty salary thing. They did, however, cause considerable problem on it by tying to it a requirement that all academic staff positions be defined, classified, so to speak, and put in ranges. And that was a condition of the spending of what the legislature appropriated for catch-up for academic staff. And that has been quite an unhappy exercise because it's been badly designed. We used an external consulting firm, Hayes Hill, which
That's
did a...
That's the recent one. Was it? I'm talking about the one back in, I don't know when.
That was part of the same package.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
It's not old, is it?
Yep. Well, the salary catch-up, faculty salary catch-up, hasn't been completed yet, you know. It was this biennium we're talking about.
Yes, that's true. You don't seem to have talked the legislature and the governor into thinking to this view of
what?
About academic staff. The view down there, evidently, is that the people who are not doing academic functions ought to be part of the classified staff, and like, for instance, financial counselors. Are there any janitors in the Madison campus who are academic staff? No.
No.
No. Apparently, there are somewhere.
No,
and then
you
the
use.
Others ought to be put with the faculty.
Where you can use the classified structure, you ought to use it. But you use the classified structure. This is the definition of it, where you have somebody who can be moved from one employer to another easily. If you got a person who doesn't even really need to be working in the university, might as well work for the Department of Revenue, mm-hmm. or the Department of Natural Resources, or DOT. If you got a person who can move in that way, then the use of the academic staff unclassified title is probably improper. But this university is loaded with people who are highly specialized. That's why you want them.
Chris, this is another major example of the difference between Madison and the other campuses, isn't it?
True, true. But even in an area like, academic counseling in LNS College, the idea that an academic counselor in the LNS College at the UW-Madison can either be moved to the Department of Public Instruction or to UW-Eau Claire and operate just as effectively is ridiculous. Here's a typical unclassifiable and therefore unclassified person.
Do you tell everybody this downtown?
Oh, sure, and they recognize this, and that's why the unclassified category does remain. Mm-hmm. I think downtown there are probably some people who feel that that because there's more flexibility in the unclassified titles, that there's a tendency to use unclassified titles when you can, even if they're not appropriate. I don't think, I don't accept that complaint. I think we've worked very hard to make sure that we don't call someone unclassified for administrative convenience, but do it only because this truly is an unclassifiable job. But the danger is there, and I guess I can understand why somebody in a Department of Employment Relations might believe that the classified position should, the category should be used more regularly. But this is not...
And do you think the academic staff are being mistreated?
I don't think they're being mistreated in the sense that...
Well, you did say you had inappropriate comparisons. So I was just quoting... Tony Earl felt that might be a reason for their wanting to bargain, associate, you know.
Well, first of all, why does Tony Earl... On what basis does he conclude that they want to bargain, academic staff?
The bargaining group is very vociferous, as I understand.
Yeah. And of the 3,500 academic staff, does anyone believe that there would be a majority vote to unionize?
Yes, I think that's fairly safe.
Well, if it's fairly safe, then isn't it... incorrect of a governor to conclude that the unclassified employees have been mistreated and that's why they want to bargain. We just finished saying that they probably don't want to bargain. No, I think there are problems that are built into, they go back to the soft money issue I mentioned. It certainly galls an academic staff member to know that the newest typist, 18 and a half years old, can work here for 6 months and then have real lifetime job security as long as she continues to do competent work. And a very well-trained academic staff person with a doctoral degree and some training beyond that is on a year-to-year appointment and doesn't know whether he or she has a job until the grant comes in. That must be galling. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably more than anything else the issue. There's also a question that I think more noise is made of than the question deserves, and that is the involvement of academic staff in the governance of the institution. The reason I think more noise is made of it is that the governance of the institution occurs at the largely at the departmental level, and in such things as allocation of space and determining of program and plans, and academic staff in most departments are very much involved in this. And the important issues around a university are not settled in the faculty senate, they're settled at the departmental level, and there is extensive representation of academic staff.